I'm Justin Chisholm, welcoming you back to the Yacht Racing Podcast. My guest on this episode is British writer and America's Cup aficionado, Magnus Wheatley. Magnus has been obsessed with yachting's oldest and most prestigious competition since the age of 16. Now appropriately based in Cowes on the Isle of Wight, Marcus has covered numerous America's Cup cycles over the years as an independent journalist. And for the 37th edition, which is scheduled to take place in Barcelona, Spain in 2024, he's been retained by the event's organisers as lead writer for the competition's official website, americascup.com. Magnus Wheatley, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the Yacht Racing Podcast. We don't know each other particularly well, but I feel like I do know you because I've been following your writing about the Cup for quite a long time. So it's a real pleasure to manage to get you on today. And I think you're talking to us from your home in Cowes, where the Cup started.
That's correct, 1851.
So, first of all, how's the weather in Cowes today? Is it a nice Cowes day?
Well, look, it's always sunny in Cowes, so it is actually a very sunny day. But yeah, winter is definitely on our doorstep, and yeah, it's getting a bit chilly. So the opportunities to go free water swimming, and I attempted to go laser sailing last weekend, but there was no wind. And the last race of the season is next weekend. So my wife very kindly bought me a winter wetsuit for my 51st birthday, which was last week. And yeah, I'm looking forward to trying it out.
Sounds like you're making the most of island life down there.
Yeah, it's a big change. We moved down here from London actually mid-pandemic. Because we were sitting in a central London townhouse going, what the hell are we doing in these four walls? And yeah, it was a fantastic move. And last summer was the endless summer, which was great. And I have my International H boat, which was my father's old boat that he won around the island in. And I've also got a laser and we've also got a rib. So yeah, we've really embraced island life. And my son, who's 15, is really into windsurfing at the moment. So I'm spending a lot of time on the beach, picking him up from various ends of the beach.
Fantastic. Well, you're doing all of that in between for the last several years, writing some fantastic insight into the America's Cup. It's clearly a passion of yours, and we've just been having a little chat before we started. But tell us when and where did this love affair with the Cup start? Because I think you told me you were pretty young, like as a teenager.
Yeah, I think obviously, like a lot of people of my age, 1983 was the big one. And my father kind of pointed me towards that victory. And I think when I read Born to Win after they'd won, it's still one of my favorite books today. And I had the great privilege of meeting John Bertrand and chatting with him and interviewing him. And just an incredible guy. But from the 83, then obviously we went into 87, which was, you know, by all reckons, one of the greatest cups ever. And as a teenager, I was getting an early train to school. I went to school in Southampton, lived in Lymington. And I apologize now for anybody who wanted to read the newspapers, because I was going in and cutting out the newspaper cuttings and then writing my own kind of, let's call it a blog, for the lack of better words. And I've still got that folder today. And it's just, it was, it really drew me in, that the people that are involved in the Cup. And I very much look at it from people and sailing as much as I do from technology. And I loved that America's Cup. I thought it was incredible. And the coverage on Channel 4 in the UK was once a week, I believe. And I always remember the White Crusader versus Stars and Stripes. Was it? Yeah, Stars and Stripes, wasn't it? Stars and Stripes match, and there was that fabulous commentary with, you know, White Crusader is submarining, and it just really captured me. And then I was very lucky. I mean, I worked in finance for a long time, and then I left that in 2002, having met the sports editor of the Financial Times, and he said, "Look, we can't pay you very much. We can't take very much from you. But would you like to go down to Auckland?" And they paid for my airfare to go come down to Auckland for the 2003 America's Cup. And that was an incredible experience, you know, meeting people like Larry Ellison, Ernesto Bertorelli, all the sailors, Russell Coutts, Brad Butterworth. I mean, Brad was an immense help to my my career, breaking stories through me. And I wrote for the FT. I wrote for Yachts and Yachting magazine, for Seahorse. And yeah, it was, that was a real, you know, being on the end. And as you know, we're very lucky now that we are on the inside of the America's Cup. It is a huge privilege to be on the inside, and to have the opportunity to write about this event, because it is, it's one of the premier events. We've got the World Cup on at the moment. And you know, there's just as much intrigue and stuff, but the America's Cup has an amplification, and it is very rich individuals wanting to win at all costs, and it's something extremely fascinating. I'm lucky enough to have Bob Fisher's An Absorbing Interest, which I think is the greatest title for a book written by a journalist on the America's Cup, because it is an absorbing interest. It literally, you know, it really gets into your soul. And for the America's Cup this time, you know, I've been writing the history and going into an awful lot of historical books, and it's fascinating. I've just done the Lipton and Sopwith era in the 1930s, the 30, 34 and 37 Cup. And, you know, Lipton's five challengers, one got very close. I mean, it's just fascinating. It really is. And it's an absorbing interest.
So where do you stand then? You go back all the way back to those cups you've just been describing, where the boats were lead mines that didn't go very fast. The races were 3.5-4 hours long. And now we've got 15-minute races with boats that are flying on foils. And every day I read on social media, oh, it's not like the old days. I've lost interest in this cup now. I find it fascinating, but where do you stand on it?
So the really fascinating thing of when you go into the real detail of anything from 1851 onwards and up to, I mean, I've got up to the Ranger era, was the technological advances, the duralumin masts that were, that the old lags, the old salts in Newport said that'll never work. That is not something for the America's Cup, or even for yachts in general. Mm-hmm. A metal mast will never work. A metal spar would never work. And then if we look at Ranger, they were building negative buoyancy into the rudder stock. There were all sorts of tricks and traits, and the way that they were coating the boats. If you go back to America, turned up in cows with flat cut sails. And again, the America's Cup has always been at the advance of technology. And I don't think, even through history, that anybody really liked any of the boats that ever competed. The before the 1937 America's Cup, they were desperately trying to move to the K class and the 12 meters, because they thought the J class were ugly, not useful boats. They had no longevity. They're incredibly difficult to say, you know, they had no purpose after the America's Cup. And so all the way through history, I don't think anyone's ever been particularly happy with the cup. I remember in the 12 meters, everybody saying, well, they're lead mines, they're dreadful, they're awful. The IACC boats, they ended up being one end of the rule, and very narrow, and quite boring, and, you know, longer races that, you know, tack jibe sets at the Windward Mark, really, okay, this is a bit boring. And so then we saw the cat eras and the fixed wings of the Deed of Gift challenges. And then we saw the extraordinary cup with Lingi versus Oracle in the Deed of Gift match. And again, I don't think anybody was happy with that, but it was an incredible spectacle. When they launched the AC75, I have to say I was one of the skeptics that looked at it and thought, goodness me, how the hell is that going to work? These kind of gecko-looking boats. But I think we could all agree that 2021 was a remarkable event. It is what it is. And when I see the boats up close, and I'm very lucky to, I was down at the Lingi base in the summer, seeing those boats up front, that they are, I have to say, quite unremarkable. They're a lot smaller than than they perhaps come across on the television screen. But the power they generate is is just phenomenal. The noises they make are frightening. And it is a real test of sailors. And I think if the America's Cup is a test of sailors and sailing, you know, the whole America's Cup was founded on the fact that we wanted to trial old world boats against new world boats. And it is a hell of a trial. And these boats are a test for the very best sailors on the planet. I mean, you and I, unfortunately, can't sail these boats.
Exactly.
I think I'd be terrified to sail them.
I mean, you make a good point because, you know, I've sailed since the age of nine. And I've always looked at boats, looked at yachts and thought, yeah, I understand the physics of this. It's just the same as the dinghies I used to sail. And if, you know, if pushed, I'd be able to probably steer one and even tack or jibe one, whatever size of boat it is. Because it's instinctively, you know, the knowledge is instinctively there. Of course, with these boats, and I have to go back to San Francisco. You know, I moved to San Francisco to cover the cup, the 34th cup.
Fourth, yep.
And I'd never seen the AC, what were they, 72s at that point. And I stood outside the yacht club one day, walked down the hill from where we were living, stood outside the yacht club in the car park and watched the Kiwis come screaming past Chrissy Field and do a foiling jibe right in front of me. And I will never forget that as long as I live. It was one of the most exciting, powerful, amazing moments, you know? And I was just like, oh my God, everything's changed now.
Well, I go back to Geelong Week in 2000. It's either 2002 or 2003. And I was grinding on board Grant Warrington's Wild Thing. Now, that makes me sound like I've got muscles. The grinder is actually electronic, so I just had to press a button, which is great. That sort of worked for me. But anyway, on the way out to the race course, Grant said, hey, guys, you're going to see something today that's going to change sailing. And there's all the kind of grizzled professionals on board. And do you remember Rowan Veal, the guy that won the Moth World Championships with, like, it was either five or seven firsts or something. He actually obliterated it back in the day. And he came along and we're kind of like, well, is this it? And he was just low riding and then he sheeted on and rose out of the water and everybody went, what the hell?
Yeah.
Did I just see that? I still think today I go down to my local sailing club and there are wasp sailors. There are foil boarders there, windsurf foil boards. I'm still really impressed by it. It still takes my breath away. And I was sailing in the fast handicap fleet and there was a wasp in front of me, capsized. I got past him because he took a little bit of time to get up. I was in my laser radial. And then he comes flying in on a port tack, you know, to the mark. And he's absolutely, you know, it's an incredible sight to see. Then when you see it at AC 75 level, it is phenomenal. And if, you know, you look at the Imokas and you look at the old teams and those kind of boats, the world is changing. I understand people that say the America's Cup isn't representative of the sailing that I do, but sailing, unfortunately, looking down the scale is changing. And, you know, my son's into windsurfing and wants to go windsurf foil boarding eventually. And that's his reason for taking up the sport. And certainly the youth sailors at my club are all, you know, they may be in RS Terrors or Optimists or mirror dinghies now, but very quickly they will get the opportunity to sail in a wasp or some other foiling craft. And there's a contemporary of my son who's 1 year younger, is 14. He's wasp sailing now, and I just think that the sport at a not an elite level, but at a progressive level is changing. I still think that we'll always have water shifting dinghies because there's some very high performance and great boats. But it's very, you know, the sport is being led by the people at the top. And people are saying, well, the trickle-down effect isn't there. But I beg to differ with the systems that are on board these America's Cup boats. They will have a trickle-down to the Imokas. They will have a trickle-down. Eventually, that will trickle all the way down. And we're already seeing the trickle-down in the dinghies.
Yeah. And the trickle-down is happening. I've just written a piece for North Sails, where I asked some, as a non-technical person, asked some questions about, you know, how they build sales now. And immediately the America's Cup stuff came up and they said, this is, you know, this is where the technology is coming from that is now being applied, you know, right the way across their range of sales. So for sure, the trickle down's
I think it's very interesting in sale technology. I have to say I don't understand it, of how they're doing it and how they're achieving it and the blow up balloons that they have going up the sale and stuff. But it is the control when you are in a rib behind an AC-75, the control that the sailors are exerting on that sale is phenomenal. And we're obviously seeing a lot of styles of sailing. We're seeing very aggressive traveler movements. We're seeing a coordination between main and jib that we haven't necessarily seen before. I saw yesterday that American Magic had Richard Bouzaid, who's a Doyle Sales honcho and round the world veteran, America's Cup winner with a Lingi. And obviously Terry Hutchinson with his association with Quantum. I think this upstairs is where a lot of the teams are focusing their energies.
Yeah, no, for sure. And this was the impression I got from the guys at North, was that this is where the battle could easily be fought, you know, more than the design of the boats or the foils or whatever. But they said you might not realize it because you might not be able to see it.
Yes, I think that's right. And certainly I was talking to my local loft in Cowes. And, you know, we're talking about the actual package that North Sails offers, the design package. You know, it's interesting that every single team has gone with North this year, this cycle. And they've gone that way for a reason. The technology of the sails is there, but also the package to refine it is there as well. So, it's a big tick for North yet again in the America's Cup.
Absolutely. Tell me something before we get too deep into the, you know, this cycle of the America's Cup. You're living in Cowes. What is the attitude to the America's Cup? I mean, it is, you know, the home of the cup originally. Are people still engaged with the whole idea, or has it kind of passed people by?
So I think I'm a member of about four clubs in Cowes, and every time I go there, somebody will sidle up to me and say, "Oh, I've heard you're working in the America's Cup. You know, what do you think?" So there is an engagement at the club level. The hardest one to engage is the younger generation. And I think, the way they engage with the media, the way they engage with how they get news in general, is served in a different way now. But the kids that I've, the sort of the teenagers, I'm any younger than that because my son's age, they will look at SailGP. They will look at America's Cup footage. They, you know, my son knows as quickly as I do that there were dolphins spotted in Pensacola, they know what the Luna Rossa boat looks like. So, yeah, I mean, Cowes has always been a very engaged place in the Cup. There's some really knowledgeable people. And there's people with long history, not only in the Cup, but in Grand Prix racing and local racing. And I get a feeling that, you know, if we could ever bring it back here, I was sitting up at the Royal Solent Yacht Club the other day and I was looking down the Solent. I mean, it is the most marvelous amphitheater for the regatta if we ever get it. And I think it would be incredible. And I think it would be a very engaging thing to bring back home. And, let's hope. From a British point of view, that Ben does it this time.
You're a little biased with your view of the Solent. Some people would argue with you on the...
Of course. And people put it out in Weymouth Bay, or they put it in Christchurch Bay, or around the back of the island. But yeah, I'm very biased on the Solent. I think it would be magnificent, particularly with those with the foiling boats, because I mean you'd have to put an exclusion zone almost the whole of the Solent, I think, because they'd be flying up there. Yeah. But whether it ever happens. I don't know.
Well, here's hoping. It'd be great to see it come back to the UK for sure. Let's get into this this current cycle of the Cup. For me, and I don't really have any way of justifying this, it feels like it's a very open Cup this time around. For sure, you would, if you were a gun to your head and you were putting $1,000 on it, you would say the Kiwis go into it as favourites just based on their track record and their reputation as innovators. They always seem to be able to come up with something new from a technology point of view. But I just get the feeling that the others are kind of snapping at their heels this time around. Is that how you see it too?
Yeah, I think it's really too early to say. As you would expect at the beginning of a cycle, the beginning of the sailing cycle, on a daily basis, teams look really good. I mean, on a given day, Alinghi looks amazing. On a given day, American Magic looks incredible. I mean, yesterday, I think they did 34 tacks and 29 jibes. They had the boat at 43 knots. And I wrote yesterday for the website that, you know, a lot of commentators are saying American Magic are looking great. I would also have said the same thing about Team New Zealand in their LEQ12 AC40. You know, I think Pete Burling and Nathan Outridge, I think Nathan Outridge was a hell of a hire for Team New Zealand. They were looking, in their pure sailing style, better and better and better every day as their confidence grew. And then the design team started putting more elements on and the boat looked even better and better. So as you say, with a gun to my head, I would certainly say Team New Zealand are the team to beat. But I look at, I like the way that Ineos is approaching this. I'm very, very impressed with the people, the standard of personnel. And Grant Dalton said a really interesting thing to me just before I started working for him. He said, Magnus, people win the America's Cup. And, you know, looking at Ineos, I think they've got the people now. And also, they've got the experience. So the sailors have got really, really good experience. And, you know, Ben is no slouch over in foiling. He is there's nobody better than him in Britain. I mean, there's just nobody better. And I think with Giles, I think there's a really good, base, and he's really interacting well with the rest of the team. Everybody seems happy, engaged, and then they've got the Mercedes factor of, you know, who are rooting this in science and data, and I think that's really interesting. And I think they will be a force, you know, come October or September 2024.
So you bring up some interesting points there. Let's just dig into that with the British team. The people, for sure, I agree with you 100%. Ben and Giles, I thought in the last cup when they came back after Christmas with the boat actually, you know, rejigged, I thought their partnership as helmsman and tactician was probably the best in the cup at that point.
Yeah.
They just looked so confident. They seem completely assured of each other's ability. They trusted each other. And I think this time, obviously, I mean, is it a given now that Giles will be the other helmsman to with Ben? I think so, don't you?
I'm really not sure, to be honest. I mean, I think they will go through a period of testing and they will make the right decision based on the numbers. You know, who else would it be? They have also indicated that there'll be some other hires coming. I don't know. I really don't know. What I can see at the moment is Giles growing into his skin, as it were, in the cup. I mean, his interviews are brilliant. And he's, you know, you'd want to work for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously, Ben is terrific. I mean, he's such an ambassador for British sailing. It's incredible. And I think, I think all round though, I look through the team of sort of Ian Jensen and people like that and go, okay, there's some real knowledge there.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, given the right design, you know, a little bit of boat speed makes you a tactical genius. You've still got to get these boats around the race course. They will get the boat around the race course. There's no doubt about that. And if Mercedes and the design team can deliver them a boat, then they are, you know, they have got to be favourites for the Challenger.
Which is my other question is, you know, we all talk about how awesome it must be to have a Formula One team and all that technical resource available to you. But there's also a risk here as well. I mean, these guys build cars, they don't build boats. And the LEQ12, you know, they famously said, this is the first yacht that Mercedes have ever built. And I don't think it's a given that it just works straight off the bat.
I think they're smart enough to know, though, that they could go herring down blind alleys, and there are probably an awful lot of shiny objects at Mercedes to go, oh, we could do this. The greatest asset that nobody has is time. Mm-hmm. So, and with people like James Allison, or whatever, they will want to root that LEQ12 in the data, but you can be damn sure that I have to say one thing. Of all the designers and design coordinators that I've spoken to and that I'm privileged to speak with, they're the coolest cookies in town at the moment. They're not stressed. They're not worried that the AC40s, you know, when the AC40 is going to come. They're not, you know, they've got to sign off on these designs pretty quickly. So a lot of them, a lot of the work has been done. A lot of the, you know, I think they know what the boat's going to look like. I think they know roughly what the foils are going to be. They'd like to validate it. They'd like to test it. But they're pretty cool at the moment. So then it goes down to the build teams, and the build teams are all like build teams always are, very cool. And it'll just happen in, you know, 2023 will be a year of building, and they'll launch in 2024. But there's a lot of the design coordinators are a little stressed at, oh, what are they doing over there? What's happening over here? They're looking for anything new that's coming. And obviously all eyes on Team New Zealand, because like you say, they're the great innovators. But I think there's all eyes on INEOS. And I think with the Luna Rossa boats, I was expecting a little bit more than that. That's a Te Rahutai clone, it looks like, from the naked eye. There's lots of little details in there that are very interesting, and lots of, you know, emphases, you know, on foils and the rig package and the control of the rig. I genuinely think that, you know, the two teams that to beat are Luna Rossa and INEOS. But then there's the Tom Slingsby factor over in Pensacola, and what I can see out there is a young team. Certainly, they've got a lot of new people in new positions, and they're throwing that thing around. They are really on rails with it, and they're putting time on the water. Again, it'll come down to their design. With a Lingi, I think this, you know, when I look at the sailors, they are brilliant. They are young and brilliant. Put them on the lakes, put them in any foiling class. Arno Sarafagas is, you know, not only is he a really good sailor, he's also grown into the role of leading that team. And a lot of all the younger sailors are all looking up to him, and he really does hold himself very well. I think they've struggled with Boat Zero. I think it's not an easy boat to sail, and I think they're doing a step by step approach, which is to be admired and is to be you know, who's to say they're wrong, and then give them a good design, which they've got Marcelino Botan and a hell of a design team around them. They could quite easily rock it up the standing. So really, I think it comes down to the design. I think all the sailors will be there or thereabouts, and because there's only eight people per team, I think that they will choose the best eight, and they all the sailors will be top draw. Mm-hmm. And so really, it comes down to the design. Who can pop up early in the given conditions? There will be a variety of conditions in Barcelona. And it's probably the most intriguing, and like you say, probably the closest America's Cup that we've had for a long time.
I've done quite a lot with the Swiss team recently. I know you have too. And the one thing I came away with every time I spoke to any of them was just even Brad, you know, cynical old Brad Butterworth. I came away with this feeling of the passion that is within that team. You know, I don't think you can underestimate the significance of a Lingi as a sporting brand in that country.
I wrote an article called "A Lingi Famille," and you know, obviously the team absolutely love that. But the closest I get the sense is a family, and you join the Lingi team. You're joining. You know, they all go skiing together. They all go off lake sailing together. It's a whole program. And I think it's a huge privilege having them in the Cup, because, and particularly with the Red Bull Association as well, they will be undoubtedly the most engaging Cup syndicate this time. They will go the extra mile. You know, they have free runners. They have the rally car screaming around the base. They are extremely accommodative to the media and to the public as well. And they're a huge asset. Obviously, when the announcement was made, when Ernesto was on that stage at the Société Nautique de Genève, there was a question from the audience. They said, you know, will money, you know, how much money are you putting in into this? And he said, money will not be an issue. So, and what you're seeing with Boat Zero is they've taken a pretty old boat and made that look almost brand new. It's in the shed at the moment. We're expecting it to come out probably with sight claws and a load of upgrades to the hydraulic systems. That's going to be very interesting. It's a real no stone unturned. And then hiring in Dean Barker and Pietro Sabello as well was a masterstroke. That's, you know, great. Bring the experience in. And you can see it when they're on board. You can see that the team are a click faster. They're more willing to go into the jibes. Tax is still a problem. But, you know, I think it's just too early to judge on Boat Zero, because I genuinely think that's a tough boat to sail in those conditions. When they get their new boat, the big test will be when they get their AC40 and they start sailing that around. Then I think we'll really see the talent that is in that Alinghi team. And I think, you know, if you put any of the sailors on board Boat Zero, I think they'd all struggle with it. I think it's a difficult boat to sail. I'll give them the benefit of the doubt on this one.
Yeah, for sure. about your superior knowledge on that. Were you surprised to see Sabello turn up in Alinghi and not do another cycle with Luna Rossa?
Yes and no. I'm not privy to what's gone on in Luna Rossa. That's an awful lot of experience to let go to another team. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a little bit like the football transfers when Man United would never sell to Liverpool or Manchester City. You know, do you let your top talent go to what could be a top, you know, could be the winning team? So yes, it's interesting, but I guess what they thought is, well, he's not going to sail on the boat because he can't. Mm-hmm. Under the nationality rules. So yeah, you know, there will be a brain drain from all of the teams to different places. So, it's just one of those things that happens with the Cup.
The other big surprise to me was that the Italians let their designer Martin Fischer go.
Yes.
And he's gone to Ineos and seems very happy at Ineos too. I mean, he designed or was heavily involved in designing the boat that was nearly good enough to win the Cup last time. I mean, it wasn't a million miles off, was it? And yet they've let that expertise and knowledge walk out of the door.
Yeah, I mean, if you wash up on Luna Rossa in 2021, that was very close to winning. And it was only a case of Grant Dalton locking the doors and giving a rollicking and saying, you've got to sail the boat better, and putting the emphasis on the sailors that really kickstarted Team New Zealand when they were at 3-all. That was a heck of a boat. And yes, he was instrumental in that design. So again, that is an interesting move. But did Luna Rossa think, well, we've gone as far as we can and we need to go further now and we need to bring in different resource? The decisions that are made in the Cup, I mean, often they are rooted in personality or they're rooted in ability, and you know, how far, where do we want to go next, what do we have to do to at 3-all to go you know, to win the next few races, what design do we need, and you just don't know what really went on, you know, behind closed doors in those things. So but it was a surprise. But as you say, I think the design team at Ineos, and I'd have to say the whole team, looks very happy at the moment. Mm-hmm. And very confident. And it's lovely from a British perspective, it's really nice to see. I think the support that they've got this time, also it's a different environment, and they're not trying to do this during COVID times. I think the support that they've got somewhere to go with the data, and they've got analysis and huge computing power to go. That must be reassuring. And if you look through Ben's campaigns, you know, he always had Sid Howlett to go to, who was, you know, the boats were immaculate. The fin was fantastic. It was right at the cutting edge, you know. But Ben, whether it's psychological or not, Ben knew that he had a boat that if he sailed it right, he could win. And Ben can obviously win races. So, I'm really excited by it. It's a little bit like saying England's going to win the World Cup. You know, it's coming home. It's coming home. I've got a real feeling about Ineos this time. And I think, good luck to them. And hopefully this recent debacle with the towing mast being perhaps excluded hasn't set them back. There's an interesting debate going on. Ruling number 26 is an interesting one at the moment, and we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, I was just looking at that this morning as well. So just for the podcast listeners who might not be following it quite as closely, just run through that. Just give it 45 seconds.
Ineos, when they first came out of the shed, appeared to have what's called a towing mast. And the rules of the America's Cup say that you cannot tank test anymore. So it looks like Ineos were going to effectively tank test at full scale. And by having a towing mast means you can have different forces exerted on the hull and perhaps extract better data. The Kiwis did this with the catamarans before they got them foiling. And it looked like potentially a very clever way of subverting the tank testing rule. A question was put in to the America's Cup Rules Committee. Anyone can have a look at it. It's Rule 26. There's the right of reply from all of the different teams. They can put their little bit in. The Rules Committee then makes a ruling. And it looks like they've outlawed, they've said you're only allowed to have one mast. A towing mast counts as one mast. Hence why we've seen Ineos going back and stepping their proper rig. But it could have wider implications for other parts of the boat. And there was an anonymous suggestion that Luna Ross's, that they had a recording device on the end of their foils, that could be part of the boat. And this ruling means that they shouldn't have that. They sailed yesterday without it. There's a lot of gamesmanship at play at the moment, but it does look like potentially the towing mast may count as the mast because it's stepped on the ball and stayed, in the place where a normal mast is. It's looking that potentially that could be outlawed, which may put them back on their data gathering exercise. Iddle for diddle. I think Ineos will be pretty cool about that. And they will just do the normal testing with sails up and get the data that way.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's a good explanation. And, I know in interviews, Bed has said that in the last cut, when the boat arrived in Auckland, it didn't live up to the expectations that the designers, it just wasn't as fast as the designers thought it was going to be. And that was because the data they had gathered, the tools they were using were not as accurate as they needed to be. And you can see that they're not going to make that mistake again, particularly with the Mercedes influence on them.
This is why I'm really excited about them, because lessons have been learned. And there's one thing, getting money from a fabulous backer like Jim Ratcliffe, who's willing not only to do one cup, but do another and say, and who's to say he wouldn't do a third. If we got close this time, he may get cup fever and say, and it's not a lot of money in his sporting estate to commit to when he's looking at buying Manchester United for eye-watering billions, a hundred or so million. We are talking fantasy numbers here, but 100 or so million is totally doable over a 2 or 3 year period. It's one thing taking that money and then just making the same mistakes again. It's another thing taking it, learning, and going, if you go back to the Charles Dunstan campaign, then you go to the Ratcliffe campaign. Now, the Ratcliffe Part 2 campaign, this is looking good. And, I think probably Jim may have had an influence in bringing in the Mercedes guys. It may have been Ben saying, look, can we use those guys? And Mercedes F1 AMG Applied Science is a hell of an organization. Now, just digging into that one a little bit further, you know, if you're an engineer at Mercedes Applied Sciences, you know, you came because you probably wanted to work on engines and cars and things, and suddenly you're working on aero packages for boats. I don't think that'll faze them too much. And they've assigned James Allison, who's probably not only a great engineer, but probably the greatest coordinator that we've seen in Formula One. And if he applies that into America's Cup, and they are bright enough not to run down dark alleys and blind alleys with this stuff.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be really compelling. I can't wait to see what they come out with.
For sure. Now, we mentioned Alinghi. It was great to see them back in the Cup. Another return to the Cup, which I'm really pleased about, is Tom Slingsby. We talked about it a little bit a couple of minutes ago. I mean, he's with the Americans. He's partnered up with Paul Goodison. Those two were really big rivals in the laser in their Olympic years. I know damn sure at that point they really didn't get on with each other. what's your thoughts on that dynamic in the team?
Slingsby is mercurial genius. I think he is the Russell Coutts, the Dennis Conner of the day. And I think he is an incredible talent. And what is really noticeable with American Magic is, I think he's only been on, he was there for a week, which I think he only did three or four, maybe 3 days of sailing. He then went off and got engaged. Congratulations, Tom. And spent a bit of time with his new wife-to-be, Helen. And then he's come back. And what I've noticed is that every time he's on board, the boat is going much faster and he's just getting better and better. I mean, yesterday's session was mega, absolutely mega. Interesting that Terry Hutchinson said afterwards that it was really good to see Goody and Tom interacting so well. I think it's an incredible afterguard, and it's an afterguard with something to prove. Jimmy Spithill and Francesco Bruni, they've been there in the Cup. Ben and let's call it Ben and Giles, they've been there in the Cup together. Does that experience outweigh two newbies effectively coming into the Cup game? I think Tom will handle the pressure extremely well. I know Goody will handle the pressure brilliantly well. And I think Tom, it could be the key ingredient, because he does have this kind of force of will that transmutes onto the rest of the team that, he's not going to look a chump at the end of this. And he's going to drag that team as far as it can go. So it's really exciting. And it's great to have Tom Slingsby in the Cup. And I don't know, we watch SailGP and how he digs out those victories. It's fantastic to watch. And, I think with SailGP, he is the poster boy for SailGP. He is compelling. And, all his interviews and all his things, he's a very determined young man. And we need him in the America's Cup. I was slightly disappointed. There was a bit of dancing around before he signed for American Magic. And some of the rumors of the money he's being paid, I'm not sure. I'm really not sure how true some of them are, but we will never know. But yeah, he's being paid well for it. But I would suspect that there were some wise heads. In fact, I know there were some wise heads that said, look, you need to be a part of this America's Cup. And he signed. And yeah. And that's great. And it's really great for the Americans. But having a Brit and an Aussie with dual nationality, a Brit and an Aussie on the helm, does the American yachting press get behind American Magic? There's quite a lot of politics around the backers and stuff. I hope they do, because there's also the politics with the New York Yacht Club as well. But I really hope that that the Americans get behind it, because I think they've got a really outstanding chance this time to go certainly one further and get into the final.
Is there a risk that Slingsby can burn himself out because he's written into his contract that he keeps his SailGP responsibilities? He's already flying around the world.
I think Sail GP and America's Cup kind of complements each other. It's it keeps the sailors sharp. Certainly, you know, Ben's very keen on carrying on with it. It keeps them sharp. Yeah, I think the traveling around the world. I mean, there's more and more events coming onto the Sail GP calendar, and at more far flung venues. So, yeah, and if I was the owner of an America's Cup boat, of America's Cup syndicate, you know, you're going to have to convince me that this flying around the world and being apart from the team for, you know, it's not a long time, maybe, you know, a week and a half or so. And I'm paying you how much, and you're going off to Dubai for, you know, the season finale or whatever. You know, I've got to be convinced of that. Now the team bosses seem convinced of that. They seem to think that they're staying match fit and they're racing against their contemporaries. And I think the two events can happily live together.
I guess we'll see the evidence in Sail GP before we'll see it in the America's Cup. If he is burnt out, then we'll see his results drop off.
Yeah, he's not showing any sign at the moment.
Well, I don't know. Dubai, he looked very wobbly on the Saturday in Dubai. And then
he comes back on the Sunday.
Absolutely.
So yeah. Maybe he had jet lag on the Saturday that caught up with him and then just turned it on. The red mist came down on the Sunday. But, you know, it's lovely having characters like that. And I think if you go back through the history of the Cup, having the characters, having the best sailors, you know, it's a wonderful thing to have in the America's Cup.
It is. And on that subject, let's talk a bit about the billionaires behind these teams, because you're right. You know, these are the guys who are putting their money on the line. It's a passion project for all of them. And I think we've got some real characters, haven't we? I mean, Jim Ratcliffe is pretty quiet spoken. He doesn't do a lot of media with the Cup, but he's no fool, is he?
No, but one of the things I can say from kind of the inside is the respect that the defender has for Jim Ratcliffe, and that's all the people all the way up to the top. I think it's been, you know, the challenger of record and defender relationship normally starts as a very happy courtship, followed by a lovely 1-year marriage,
yeah,
and then descends into acrimony and divorce.
Yeah.
And the history of the Cup shows that. What I think you've got is, you know, a no-nonsense individual at the top of Ineos, and I think you've got a no-nonsense individual at the top of Emirates Team New Zealand. And it has been an absolute pleasure to formulate the rule, set the tone, and you know, that's what I'm hearing. And there's a very good relationship there. And I think I watched a Financial Times interview where Jim Ratcliffe was on stage. He was talking about a wide range of issues. He only mentioned the America's Cup very, very briefly. But what you're seeing is a very pragmatic guy, a risk taker who, you know, sailed very close to the wind after the general financial crisis and in 2008. And, you know, has positioned his private company to be, you know, extremely successful in all the fields that it competes in. His ventures into sport with the football clubs, the cycling teams, everything else, and Mercedes Formula One, obviously, are, you know, passion plays. And he's really interested in it, and he's really genuinely supportive. And, you know, if you speak to Ben or you speak to any of the team, they speak with the highest regard for Jim Ratcliffe, which is great.
Yeah.
So you've got a great team boss there. And if we look around the other teams, you know, with the billionaire backers, you know, the Prada guys, you know, would die in a ditch for Patrizio Bertelli. You know, and I have to say that the several times when I've been on Zoom calls with him over COVID, or when I met him in, you know, back in the day in the Cup in Auckland, he's terrific. He's like your grandfather. You know, he's a terrific guy, and he's incredibly supportive, and the team absolutely adore him. And then you go down to you know, Ernesto at Alinghi, and you know, he's sailing on the boat. He's been out training, I think, two or three times now. And they all sail with him on the lakes, and the just the highest respect from the sailors. And I don't think it's a false respect. It's not just because you're paying me that you're, you know, that I'm friendly with you, that I like you. I genuinely think they really, really like him. And you know, he does command, you know, a certain respect as the owner, but I think also there's a great deal of fun there and a great, you know, so there's some really good backers. You know, if we go back, you know, in the history of the Cup and you look at, you know, the Liptons and the Sopwiths and people like that, you know, they were dictatorial. Sopwith allowed, you know, his professional crew on Endeavour 2 to mutiny because they all wanted to go back to the fishing boats in the winter, and the America's Cup was going to be in the winter. And he sailed with an amateur crew. So, you know, there are histories of tyrant cup sponsors, or, you know, people at the very top. And I think the current regime and the people in charge are, you know, very supportive. And you look at the Americans, Doug DeVos, fantastic. I mean, you know, he's pushed on through all that New York Yacht Club nonsense. You know, he kept the faith, kept the team together, you know, terrific backer for the Americans.
Yeah, that was really classy, I thought, the way they just rode that whole situation out.
I was just going to say, and I was on record quite a lot of saying about Terry Hutchinson. I mean, I think he is a model CEO. If you were, you know, I've worked for a number of CEOs that are nowhere close to how Terry operates, how he got, and reading afterwards of how he got through the crash in 2021, and, you know, the emotional toll that took. I have the highest regard for Terry. I think he is the you know, the model, you know, president of sailing operations and skipper that you could possibly have. I think he's brilliant.
Yeah, he's been freed up this time a little bit, hasn't he? I interviewed him recently, and his role, they've taken a lot of the kind of the big picture stuff away from him. His role is now the sailing and the team. And he, you know, I asked him a direct question about that, and he said he was much happier in that situation.
I think he looks a lot happier. He's got to manage certainly one big superstar sailor and integrate him with Paul Goodison and the rest of the team. And I think he's relishing that. And I have to say, I every time I see Terry, he looks like he's enjoying it now. And I think, you know, what the public face that we saw post the crash, how he held that together. And, you know, he freely admits he went home and burst into tears, and, you know, it was a hell of a thing. And it was a very emotional roller coaster, but he's emerged from it. And I genuinely look at him now and think he's enjoying it. And he's coming across as enjoying it, but very grounded. When he was asked, you know, you look like the favorites, he went, yes. Been there, done that. Talk to me in October 2024. Thought, yeah, good for you, Terry. You know what you're doing.
Yeah, for sure. And in the interview I did with him, he said, well, you know, we're doing the interview. It's X many days before the Cup starts in Barcelona, and I said, Terry, are you looking at that on a clock on the wall somewhere? And he tapped his head and said, no, the clock's running in my head here, and that's who he is. Like he's.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So professional. And
yeah, very professional. Yeah.
Okay. We're kind of running up
Barcelona.
To
Barcelona.
We're running up to the time limit that we said we'd set, but let's push on for a little bit. Let's talk about, as you say, Barcelona, the venue. I'm not really interested in talking about whether it should have been in Auckland or not. I think everybody would have loved to go to Auckland. But from my point of view, I can see the commercial realities of why it's there. And just my two penneth on that subject, if you want to promote New Zealand to the rest of the world, there's no point in trying to do it in New Zealand. Get out in the world. And I think New Zealand will do very well from the Cup in Barcelona and the promotion that it gets.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't flipped it on its head like that. That's a very interesting point. I mean, I have to say, I mean, I've been down to Barcelona a few times now, and it's a marvelous place to hold the America's Cup. The city and the people are, you know, highly engaged, wanting to be entertained. They, you know, you can always take the temperature of these things by the local taxi drivers, and they all talk about the Copa America, and they're very excited to see that their city is being invested in.
Yeah.
And a lot of it comes from that angle of it's being invested in, and that the government and the mayor and people are doing something for us. And I think they're very grateful for the Cup. They've certainly moved heaven and earth so far, and are going to move more heaven and earth to accommodate the Cup. if you go down to the Port Olympic, down just down the coast where the AC40 will be, it's virtually all been cleared and it's ready to go. They will put up the structures to house the teams, and that will be a real center of focus, I think. And you know, the cup teams, you've got Ineos and Alinghi right in the middle. I mean, literally right in the middle of, there's a shopping center one side, an aquarium, an IMAX theater, and then you've got Ineos and you've got Alinghi nestled in between. It's going to, I think it's going to be, from a fan engagement point of view, I think it's going to be knockout sensational. And certainly the focus that I hear from the organizers and from everybody I work with is, you know, that fan engagement is primary. You know, there's going to be an America's Cup village. You know, I can only guess what Red Bull are going to do, because it's a marvelous opportunity. So the opportunity for sponsor activation, which is the hardest thing in sailing. I mean, I've, in previous firms that I've worked with, always pushed the marketing budget towards sailing, and I've sponsored events in Cowes. The activation is so hard, and getting bang for buck is so difficult to achieve at a local level. But, you know, when you look at the America's Cup and the amount of money they're going to be putting into this, you know, Barcelona offers a magnificent return for those sponsors. The sailing venue itself, just off the beach, is tricky. It is, you know, there's a wave pattern there that is, at almost all angles of the wind, is very tricky, lumpy, and it's got a kind of a backwash off the man-made, you know, it's a man-made beach and a man-made structure of the port. There's wave patterns there. I mean, I was down, I went down to the Port Olympic a few times. The AC40s are going to have fun getting out of the port in certain conditions. The wind, when I was there in the summer, in August, there was all sorts of training and sailing going on, lots of laser sailing, lots of catamaran sailing and stuff going on. You know, the wind was certainly, there's certainly enough wind for America's Cup sailing, and that's a given. And in September and October, obviously early September, you start to get the strange breezes coming off the Atlantic, which causes the mistrals and the big seas. So, you know, there will, and then what remains after that, as that moves into the Mediterranean, and then what comes after that will be very interesting sailing days. As I said, I think the designers at the moment in the America's Cup are probably the coolest cucumbers around there. But I think it's I think that it's a difficult design brief. I think it's, because you could be out there in 5 to 8 knots of breeze, you could be out there in 15 knots of breeze. And quite easily, you know, in higher wind ranges. And I remember an Alinghi designer saying to me, "So, Magnus," you know, I said, "Well, what do you think of the conditions?" He said, "Well, if you can tell me what the conditions are going to be like in 2024, I'd pay you a lot of money." And yeah, you just don't know. Yeah. But yeah, all around the city, I mean, obviously it's a football city. It's Barcelona FC is a religion down there. But they are very proud to have held the Olympics. They're very proud to be now hosting the America's Cup. And I think the America's Cup will do a very, very good job for Barcelona.
And there'll be a huge influx of people from across Europe. The Brits will come. Sailing fans all over Europe. It's just so easy to get to.
It is. It's such an easy venue to get to. And, you know, the ride in from the airport is, you know, 15 minutes. And you're right there. You're right in the heart of it. And that downtown area, you know, the Ramblers, you know, down to the Port Vell. It's amazing. You know, it's a complete amphitheater. I went to the sailing club there, the Real Sporting Club de Barcelona. And, you know, they've got, you know, huge opportunities to promote sailing and, you know, and to host the America's Cup. And it's fantastic for them. It really is.
It's going to be something to look forward to for sure. Now, Magnus, what are the kind of milestones the fans should be looking for now between now and the Cup? Obviously, the teams we're still in the early days of this. We've got surrogate boats or LEQ-12s. We've got boats from the last Cup being sailed. When might we start to see the new generation AC-75?
We won't see them till 2024. So it takes roughly I understand, roughly a year to build. But I think that'll be shortened to about 7 or 8 months or so. I think the next milestones is the AC40 deliveries. Ineos apparently does have their boat. We haven't seen it yet. Alinghi then gets their, or sorry, Team New Zealand get their second boat. The Alinghi one is being built in, still in McConaughey's in China. And then I'm guessing that American Magic, there's no published build schedule of those. But once the teams have all got their AC40s, they either leave them in the one design mode or they start using them as LEQ12s. I would suggest probably most of the works teams will start using them as LEQ12s. We'll start to see, you know, they're only allowed to change so many foils, so many bits and pieces. We'll start to see a few little interesting things on design there. And I think then the AC40 scene is going to be extremely interesting because you've got the youth in America's youth and women's America's Cups. I'm really excited about the women's America's Cup because I think that I certainly know some of the people who are coming through who are desperate to get on that AC40 and desperate to get going with it. And they can't come soon enough. And I think they're going to be a highly visual and high. I think they're going to cause a real riot down in Barcelona. And I really look forward to it. And the youth teams will be magnificent. And I know the Brits are going to do a split team, so male and female on their youth team. And I hope all the other teams follow that as well. So that's going to be a really vibrant part of the Cup. Plus, we've just announced that the youth final will be in the middle of the Challenger final, and the women's final will be in the after race 5 of the America's Cup. So that's really exciting. And I think that's a big nod to where the America's Cup is going to go in the next Cup. And I argued, hollowed into a void of saying mandates work. I think we have to have women on the America's Cup boats. We've had them on boats since 1864. And in 1937, Gertrude Vanderbilt was on Ranger, and so there's a history of women in the America's Cup, and I think it's only right that in the 38th Cup that they are on those boats. I understand why we're doing a women's America's Cup. I understand the skills gap that is being breached, and the power gap and whatever. I think all those things are totally achievable. I agree with Matt Sheehan, who spoke at the recent forum in Malta, and said exactly the same. And I think it will happen. So that's going to be really interesting. As far as the America's Cup's concerned, I think we will see. We'll start to see the first designs at the end of 2023. Hopefully, we'll start to see. We'll get some racing next year in the AC40s with all the teams. What I'm really excited to see is someone like Alinghi taking an AC40 and showing us just what they can do. And that's going to be really, really interesting. And that's going to happen in short order in the new year. American Magic will get theirs in the springtime. They will be very interesting. And I think we'll start to see the sailors form in those AC40s. So 2023 is going to be a year of AC40s. I'm really excited to see the Ineos LEQ12 sailing for the first time. That's going to be interesting. And, then we get into 2024 and the reveals, and my goodness me, for us Cup aficionados, that's like Christmas Day. So
yeah, for sure. And I think we will start to hook people in to the whole excitement of it. It's, you're churning out some great stories on the America's Cup website. I think the recon program, one of the big side benefits of that is that we've got access to stories and information from the teams, photos from within the compounds, and you're doing a great job of churning those out. I'm sure you'll continue to do that over the months. And I think that we need to just build it steadily on the way to 2024.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hugely impressed by people like, Mozzie Sales and stuff, who, they go into such incredible detail, and that really does appeal to quite a wide audience now. I think he's up to 20,000 subscribers, which is just fantastic. And it's presented in such a beautiful way, an accessible way. It's really, really good. With the recon stories, we're writing for a slightly different audience, and what we want is that anybody that lands into the America's Cup website can have a read around and go, oh, okay, I kind of get this. we're not going to hit them with too much jargon. But it's, we've also started to put the Mozzie Sails and the Italians and Sail World, you know, Richard Gladwell does a terrific job. We've started to put those on the website as well. So it's all there now. And it's there in a way that's never really, I mean, Mozzie was doing it in the last cup brilliantly well. But, you know, I think we're making it as accessible as we can. And obviously, you know, from a recon, there are recon teams on the, you know, at every team. From my perspective, looking at all of those things, I then have to distill and bring that data to life in a story on a daily basis and try and make it engaging and try and point to where things are changing sailing style. You know, we can just dive down a technical avenue. But that loses a certain portion of the audience. So it's a balancing act. I'm not sure whether we've got it right. I'm not sure whether we've got it, you know, but it's certainly a lot better than what we've had before.
Do you get any feedback? Are you getting a sense of how those stories are being received?
Not really, no. we can certainly see the viewing numbers. You know, I certainly know from the aficionados, the people who are really into the detail, that the recon stories aren't detailed enough. They think we're holding stuff back. We're genuinely not holding anything back. We're giving people exactly what the recon teams are capturing. And, you know, there are, from my angle, I've never been told by anybody, you know, don't say this about that. In fact, the most open team is Team New Zealand. And, you know, I read things said about Team New Zealand that are just so wrong, and it's really interesting to hear, to see that, and then you know from the inside that they're completely wrong, and that, you know, somehow there's a, you know, there's a big conspiracy theory going on behind the scenes. Genuinely, we are putting out and outputting as much as possible. We publish all the rule stuff on the notice board. There is an area where teams can ask questions. We publish all of those. There just genuinely aren't that many questions. I have never been told to not say something, mm-hmm. which, you know, from a journalistic point of view is great. I've never been held back in what I say. I was talking the other day about, you know, a feature on the Team New Zealand boat. They were completely cool with publishing that. There's a very even hand, and people may choose to believe or not believe that, but that is the truth. And we are trying to bring to life to a wide audience, also a Spanish audience as well. So a lot of these things are translated into Catalan and into Spanish. But we're also bringing the Mozzie Sails stuff and the real technical and the really going into the detail and fantastic, you know, real rich content that someone like that produces. We've given Mozzie access to the recon folders and, you know, go for your life and zero in on those little things that we, on a daily basis, when I've got to write five reports or four reports a day, we may well miss. But that's another very, very valuable, you know, resource for the America's Cup. It's all about content, really.
It is. It strikes me that you're as passionate about this job as you are about the America's Cup. You're really enjoying yourself, I think, aren't you?
It's, you know, I can't speak highly about the people that employed me. I can't speak more highly about the opportunity that I've got. It's a complete dream to be doing what I'm doing, and you know, to have the opportunity and working with some fantastic people. That's it in any job. If you get really good people, real can-do people, I have to say, Team New Zealand. It's no surprise why they've won the America's Cup. I mean, they're so can-do, so open, so accessible, and it's a massive pleasure. I'm thoroughly enjoying it.
Well, it's great. I'm going to take that as a nice way to wrap us up, Magnus. Thanks a million for joining me today, taking the time out. It's been really good fun. I'm sure the listeners will enjoy it.
Thank you, Justin. It's a real pleasure to be on my first ever podcast.
That's it for this edition of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My thanks to Magnus Wheatley for taking the time to talk to me. And thanks, of course, to all of you for listening around the world as always. I'll be back soon with another great yacht racing guest, but until then, I'll just say, sail fast, everyone.